The Sunstone Foundation presents A Moist East Wind, Pagan Sources of Misogyny and Erotophobia in Christianity. Recorded live in the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Misogyny and Erotophobia in Christianity by Terrence Day, and the respondent will be Mary Beth Raines. I'm Janie Fleet, and I want to remind you that each session is being recorded, and you are more than welcome to get a copy of the tapes of any of the sessions that you want. Just check out in the lobby and place your order. Our first speaker then is Terrence Day. He's currently a news writer employed in a non-academic role in the College of Agriculture and Home Economics at Washington State University. He was a newspaper reporter for 11 years in Wyoming, Utah, and Washington, and that included a stint for the Deseret News. He attended BYU and has written freelance magazine articles. He's been a photographer and was a consultant to the International Livestock Center for Africa and Ethiopia. In addition, Mr. Day has been called as an expert witness before the U.S. Senate and House on public perceptions of food prices, being cited 8 times in Claude W. Gifford's article entitled Advice for Young Communicators, Suggestions from Some of the Best Professionals. He has a chapter entitled Religious Roots of Do's and Don'ts in Gloria J. Fisher's What You Probably Don't Know About Sex, Readings in Human Sexuality. He has published an article called The Parent's Guide, Sex Education or Erotophobia in Sunstone, and presently has another article at Press 4 Sunstone, this one called Onanism and Mormonism, Societal Influences on LDS Attitudes Toward Masturbation. Terrence Day is married to Ruth Thompson. They have 6 children, with the oldest a law student at the U of U, another a computer program, one an illustrator, one in the Peace Corps in Niger, one married and living in Germany, with the youngest still in high school. Mr. Day.
I need to adjust the title due to an error of my own in preparing the advanced material for this. I forgot which direction the wind was blowing. It's a moist south wind. Humorist Peter Freundlich has written very insightfully about the depths of erotophobia in American culture. In an article in Esquire magazine, A Pretty Girl is Like a Malady, How I Lost My Eyesight and Why It Was Worth It, Freundlich portrays boyhood fears that his optometrist will look into his eyes and discover on his retinas the latent images of lust-upholstered parts of female anatomy. For the youth has crammed his eyeballs with the effigies of a tattered girly magazine. Freundlich imagines his myopia is caused by intently staring at the forbidden icons of the female form. Although his optometrist does not mention anything that he might have seen on the retinas, he does prescribe eyeglasses. These, Freundlich interprets as punishment. Poor Freundlich is doomed to go through life wearing a constant reminder of his youthful indiscretion, spectacles hanging on his nose and ears like the ancient mariner's albatross. He has looked into forbidden matters. Freundlich's droll fiction is a delicious reminder of how deeply the fear of sex is embedded in the Christian psyche. The sexual revolution of the 1960s and early 70s notwithstanding, Christian cultures, including the Mormon culture, still view sex as something fearsome, if not downright ugly and sinful. This paper examines the source of this all-pervasive erotophobia, along with misogyny, which often seems to be a companion of erotophobia. My studies have not yet made it clear what, if any, link there is between these two phenomena, either anciently or in modern times. But we find them arising together from a common source in ancient paganism. As I studied these two themes, a third topic suggested itself, misogyny, which is genophobia. Thanks to contemporary feminists, misogyny, which is the hatred of women, has become almost a household word. But we rarely, if ever, hear about genophobia, which is fear of the female sex, although it is listed in the Encyclopedia of Psychology as one of the major fears reported in the clinical literature. I suspect that much of what we label misogyny is actually genophobia. Fear and hatred are not the same, although they may be closely linked. One wonders if genophobia might be a precursor of misogyny or perhaps even a causal agent. But delineating between the two is beyond the scope of this paper. Just keep in mind, as when you hear misogyny, that genophobia may be involved or may actually be the real subject. G-Y-N-O-phobia. Psychologists have long told us that the brain is the primary sex organ. Whether consciously or by accident, conservative Christian theology attacks sex at its roots, in the mind. It is deemed sinful not only to engage in sexual activities outside the bounds of holy matrimony, but merely to think about sex. And even married couples may sin in thinking too much about sex. Among Latter-day Saints, there is perhaps a corollary with misogyny, wherein mere discussion of ordaining women to the priesthood risks charges of heresy. Although unrecognized and perhaps vehemently denied, one wonders if it is not a festering hatred of women that elicits death threats against those who publicly entertain the notion of ordaining women. Such rage is blind to or ignorant of the practice of women officiating in LDS temple ordinances without benefit of ordination. The mere fact that we may not freely think about and discuss sex and the status of women in the church is in itself powerful evidence of erotophobia and misogyny in operation. In earlier papers on various aspects of Mormonism and human sexuality, I have discussed mainly modern history and have only mentioned in passing the roots of contemporary attitudes. Some have been shocked that I have associated them with paganism. I am pleased today to expose those roots in some detail. In fact, this should have really been the first of the three papers that I've presented in this forum, because in an important way, I think it provides a foundation for understanding the earlier two. But I frequently do things backwards, so. It is commonly understood that the Old Testament reflects the powerful misogyny of the ancient Hebrew culture in which women were mere chattel, the property of men. But its highly positive values on human sexuality are much less recognized. It surprises many people to learn that some modern scholars now suggest that we rescue Christianity from sex-negative values by returning to the understanding of ancient Israel. Pre-Christian Judaism recognized two purposes in marriage. Both were spelled out in Genesis. They are procreation and companionship, the latter including sexual affection. The Halakha teaches us that all should marry, even the weak, the old, and the sterile who have no hope of procreation. But ancient Judaism made an even stronger case for the appropriateness of human sexual affection. Sexual pleasure was not only permissible between a man and a wife, it was mandatory. The Halakha spells out a wife's conjugal rights, considering them to be explicitly indicated in Exodus 21 and 10. The Talmud enjoins scholars to have conjugal relations with their wives on the Sabbath eve. Rashi explains the grounds for this is that the Sabbath is for pleasure, rest, and physical enjoyment. Nomenides goes even further, stating that the sexual act is an holy act, and therefore should be performed on the holy day. Further evidence of a pro-sexual attitude among ancient Jews was their frequent employment of the same word roots for both sexual and spiritual love. Since much of the modern Bible was translated from ancient Greek writings, Christian theologians have made much of the distinction between the Greek words eros and agape. But Gordas points out that no such distinction existed in the ancient Hebrew text. He notes that the same root, ahava, is properly applied to all aspects of love. Thus, Gordas says, Deuteronomy 6 and 5, He uses the same root to describe man's relationship to God that Psalms 7 and 7 uses to revere the love of man for woman. In Deuteronomy, the commandment is, "Thou shalt love the Lord your God." In the Song of Songs, the psalmist is enraptured, "How fair and how pleasant you are, O love, with your delights." The same root word. Old Testament prophets frequently employed sex as an allegory for man's relationship to God and vice versa. In these allegories, God is the husband of Israel and Christ the bridegroom of the church. Old Testament condemnations of sex usually were in the context of censuring worship of pagan fertility gods through ritualized sex, including sacred prostitution. If it isn't contained in the Old Testament and does not derive from ancient Judaism, whence comes erotophobia to Christianity? Scholars have long understood that the layman does not yet suspect, which is that the roots of erotophobia are firmly embedded in ancient pagan philosophy, from which it was infused into both Judaism and nascent Christianity. It is neither necessary nor possible to trace these ideas to their origins because they are so old as to predate written history. They are clearly evident hundreds of years before Christ. For our purposes, we shall take them up with Orpheus in the 6th century B.C. Orpheus is a mystical figure who may or may not have really lived. He is credited with founding Orphism by reordering the Bacchic rites that centered around the Thracian deity of vegetation, Dionysus Zagreus. Modern scholars believe that the Orphic cults taught that in this life the soul is undergoing punishment by imprisonment in mortal flesh. The pure life, which involved a great deal of sexual asceticism, was supposed to help release the soul from its prison and help or obtain immortality. Although the Orphic mysteries never were officially incorporated into the state religion of classical Greece, they enjoyed a great vogue and exercised considerable influence on the Pythagoreans and on Plato. Arthur Darby Knock, which is a tongue twister for me, at the time of his death in 1963, was acclaimed as the world's leading scholar of the religion of later antiquity. He credits Pythagoras with establishing the belief in a disciplined life as a preparation for immortality. It was a lasting notion. Pythagoras, who was born in 580 BC, divided the universe into two opposing principles, which could be expressed, among other things, as light and darkness, odd and even, right and left, male and female. Light, odd, right, and male were good. Darkness, even, left, and female were evil. As Vernell Bullock notes in Sexual Variance in Society and History, grouping the female sex with the inferior principle of darkness, the opposite of the male, had a profound effect on the way women were perceived. The remnants of this Pythagorean view of women remains a hidden poison in Western civilization today. In Pythagorean philosophy, bodies are governed by evil passions, indwelling furies, they are called, that must be overcome by escaping the domination of fleshly passions. Sexual activities were the ultimate pandering to the indwelling furies. Although Pythagoras stopped short of advocating total abstinence from sex, some of his followers did not. Empedocles, the influential devotee of Pythagoreanism, denounced all forms of sexual intercourse. His was, after all, only a logical extension of Pythagorean assumptions. Here, if not earlier in the history of Western, civilization, the unmistakable roots of both erotophobia and misogyny are laid bare. As one of the most influential of the Pythagorean philosophers, Plato perpetuated the erotophobic, misogynistic philosophies of Pythagoreanism. Because of his pervasive influence on generations of philosophers, including many early Christian philosopher theologians, Plato undoubtedly had more influence on the infusion of these values into Western civilization than any other single person. Plato taught that our material bodies are evil and that we live most righteously when we deny our bodily appetites. He said, "So long as we have the body with us and our soul is mixed up with this evil, we shall not attain satisfactorily of our aim of finding truth. It infects us with loves, desires, fears, all kinds of fancies, and much nonsense, with the end result that we lose our intellectual ability. In the present life, we come closest to knowledge if we avoid as much as possible all contact or intercourse with the body and keep ourselves pure from it until God Himself shall set us free." Plato, following Pythagoras, conceived of love in dualistic terms. Sacred or higher love flowed from the mind and character. It implied self-mastery. It cured the disease of physical craving. Profane love involved base instincts. Copulation, he believed, lowered man to the frenzied passions of beasts. Even in marriage, coitus is inherently evil and should be only engaged in for the purpose of procreation. Plato taught that man was bisexual in the beginning and that the division of humans into male and female sexes was a result of punishment for sin. He also taught that men who were cowards or who led unrighteous lives would become women in the second generation. Plato's was the dominant influence on philosophy and theology until the 13th century A.D. Knox states, "The Christian thinkers like Clement of Alexandria found room in their systems for very much of Platonism, which in the second century of our era was a rising force, and both Christians and pagans found a striking similarity between philosophic and Christian teachings." This assessment is shared by the LDS scholar, the late James L. Barker, who wrote, "The doctrines of Plato and his latest interpretations continued to influence the ablest thinkers among the followers of the gospel and the philosophy of the church during the entire Middle Ages, merely re-echoes the teachings of the great Athenian philosophers." One of many examples of Plato's influence on Christianity was through Justin Martyr, the second century Christian apologist, who believed that Plato was a Christian before the birth of Christ. A convert to Christianity, Justin believed that philosophy was man's greatest possession and taught that Christianity was the supreme and one true philosophy. Justin confirmed Christian doctrines by showing that they agreed with Plato or with the Stoic view. Arthur C. McGifford, author of A History of Christian Thought, held that Justin gave only a Christian overlay to the common moral philosophy of the day embraced by attitudes of his contemporaries. Tatian believed that philosophy was a forerunner of revelation from God, a view that reappeared with Peter Abelard 9 centuries later. This student of Justin believed that marriage was corrupt and that sexual intercourse was the invention of the devil. Plato's student Aristotle also played an important role in perpetuating erotophobia and misogyny. Aristotle considered women to be mutilated males. He believed that God is immaterial, having no sensations or appetites, no sense of desire, no passions. From this philosophy, it was a natural leap to the conclusion that God is without body parts or passions, and that sex, inasmuch as it is a function of the physical body, is not divine but gross and sinful. Aristotle believed that God always prefers to create a male, that women are accidents caused perhaps by a moist south wind blowing at the time of conception. Epicurus, disciple of Democritus and founder of the Epicurean school, condemned sex. He taught that sexual intercourse never benefited any man and that the good life could not result from sexual intercourse with women. The Epicurean school exercised influence in the Roman times. Carius Lucretius, and it was its best known Roman adherent, he held that sexual desire was a sickness and advised wise men to avoid the madness of sex altogether. During the meridian of time came one of the principal figures in the infusion of misogyny and erotophobia into both Judaism and nascent Christianity. He was Philo Judaeus, the Alexandrian Jew. Philo taught that men who mated with their wives when they had not intent of begetting children were like pigs or goats. He condemned husbands who copulated with barren wives for destroying creative germs and purposeless pleasure-seeking. As we have seen, this philosophy was at odds with the historical Jewish attitude that sex was wholesome and healthy. It also perpetuated mistaken notions about the science of procreation. Philo expressed the Platonian philosophy of the inferiority of women in the theory that man represented intelligence and woman sensuality. He taught that pleasure is the source of all evil and that salvation is achieved, quote, not by moderation, but by the complete absence of passion. Thus Philo fused misogyny and erotophobia. Woman was responsible for the sexual temptation of man, a notion that is still evident in current Christian cultures, wherein the onus for controlling sexual desire in romance is placed upon women. We males are so lost in the pursuit of purity and reason that we are helpless against the blandishment of female wiles. Therefore, women must be careful not to tempt us, lest we fall Icarus-like into a sea of sin, our celestial feathers singed by the heat of passion's furnace. At the time of formative Christianity, the predominant philosophies throughout the Roman Empire held that women were bad and sexual intercourse was evil. Christianity developed in competition with many other religions and philosophical systems in a polymorphous environment. The Hebrew nation still occupied its holy land, but they were captives in their own country. Many sects arose within Judaism between 150 BC and 150 AD, and many of them were of a messianic nature, largely in revulsion at the corrupt world around them and convinced that the Messiah would soon appear and save them from their sufferings at the hands of the Romans. Many of these sects renounced the values of the world and adopted an ascetic lifestyle. Christianity was influenced by the milieu of competing religions and philosophical concepts at this time, as was one of its greatest rivals, Gnosticism. The intense rivalry between Christianity and Gnosticism intensified the influence of what rivals said and did on the emerging religion. Early Christian communities' attitudes about sex depended to a degree on the practice of its leading rival in the local community. The result was that individual Christian communities or congregations adopted varying degrees of sexual repression. Some permitted copulation only for the purpose of procreation. Others demanded that celibacy be practiced by all church members, including married couples. Vern Bullock observed, at times it seems that the early Christians tried to gain status, if not adherence, by outdoing the pagan rivals at ascetic practices. As the Christian church developed, it too was rife with competing factions. But asceticism was an almost universally shared trait among those who looked for deliverance from the oppression under which they lived. And that asceticism took firmest root in the sexual quotient of human nature. It's commonly understood by modern biblical scholars that Paul's advice against marriage had its roots in his ardent conviction that Christ would be resurrected during his lifetime, ushering in the cataclysmic end of the world. Among the early Christian fathers, Paul is most associated with sexual issues and is often considered misogynistic. Paul proclaimed himself a Pharisee, son of a Pharisee, but apparently was deeply influenced by his upbringing in Tarsus, a Greek city in Asia Minor. From his Greek culture, Paul probably absorbed some of the moral dualism of pagan philosophy, which we have here traced back to Pythagoras. The depth of this influence is a matter of learned disputation at this time. The author of Early Gentile Christianity notes that many Stoic ideas were so widespread in Paul's time that no educated man could escape their influence. Poor Paul, the ancient apostle, has taken one of the bummest raps in all of recorded history. Much of the sex negativism attributed to Paul is found in a misreading of 1 Corinthians 7, verses 1 through 9, which is a clear endorsement of marriage. Indeed, it is even more. It is an emphatic statement of sexual rights, including women's sexual equality. Almost unanimously, modern scholars agree that when Paul wrote, "It is not good for a man to touch a woman," that he was not stating either his opinion nor any doctrinal position, but that he was restating a question asked of him by Christians living in Corinth. Paul goes on to advise that both husbands and wives have an obligation to satisfy their spouse's sexual needs. It is not merely permissible for them to have coitus, it is an obligation. Paul recognized that both men and women have legitimate needs for sexual affection. This is in harmony with Old Testament values and with Jewish tradition. And I would submit that this is the fundamental sexual ethic of Christianity in apostolic times. It is a fundamentally positive and healthy ethic, but one that was soon to be perverted, to be stood on its ear by pagan philosophers. During the first two centuries after Christ, moral dualism in its various forms was popular throughout the regions of the world in which the Christian church was developing. This thread of philosophy running through early church theology is known to modern scholars who have traced various philosophical elements from philosopher to philosopher, from theologian to theologian, to our very own generation. As we have already seen, both the Jews and the earliest Christians were influenced by pagan philosophy. That influence appears to have accelerated and magnified in the earliest days after the deaths of the original apostles. Numinius of Apamea, a second century writer, was among many who easily blended philosophical and theological systems. Numinius attempted to trace the teachings of Pythagoras and Plato to their original sources. In Numinius, moral dualism reached its most extreme view of God, which was so pure that he was neither in touch with the world nor even concerned about it. Numinius taught that individual salvation consisted of the abandonment of sexual activity which would liberate the soul from all passion. Gnostic leader Julius Cassianus taught that men were most like beasts when they engaged in coitus, and that Jesus was sent to the earth to save men from copulating. The second century Roman theologian Tertullian exclaimed, "Woman, you are the gateway of the devil." He blamed woman for the Savior's death and called her a temple built over a sewer. To Marcion, the second century founder of the Marcionites, it was inconceivable that God could be the author of sex. He decried the disgusting paraphernalia of reproduction. Origen, a brilliant Christian philosopher who taught with acclaim at Alexandria and later at Caesarea, and who edited the Bible in six parallel Hebrew and Greek versions, emasculated himself, although he later expressed sorrow, as we might imagine. So many Christians of his era submitted to castration that the church finally had to take sanctions against the practice. Plotinus, who lived in the 3rd century AD, was a non-Christian philosopher, but he is very important to us because of his long-lasting influence on Christian philosophers. He based his teachings on Plato and Aristotle, among others. He studied in Alexandria and was strongly influenced by Stoicism. And out of this complex philosophical inheritance, he created a philosophy of his own, which we know as Neoplatonism. Plotinus taught that pure love was not born of a mother and has no part in marriage. He followed Plato's division of love into pure, passionless love and the vile form given expression in marital sexuality. Porphyry, a 3rd century philosopher, believed that coitus was defiling and virginity the epitome of purity. But it was not only sex that was sinful to Porphyry. He condemned all kinds of pleasure, including sexual intercourse under any circumstances. a 3rd century religious figure who was crucified in southern Babylonia. Moni was reared in a Babylonian Baptist sect. Manichaeanism incorporated aspects of Gnosticism, Christianity, Zoroastrian, and Greek teachings. Adherents sometimes were referred to as the lost Gnostics. Between the 4th and the 12th centuries, Manichaeism was seen by many as a serious rival of Christianity. As Mohammed would do later, Moni taught that he was the last of the prophets. An important feature of Manichaeism insofar as it relates to human sexuality was its acceptance of the Gnostic principle of moral dualism. Manichaeans believed that sexual intercourse chained the soul to Satan. They taught that even procreation is defiling, and that the very impulse to sex was evil. Manichaeans divided the universe into two kingdoms, of light and of darkness. Both were eternal and uncreated powers in everlasting opposition and conflict. Although the God of light alone was prescient, eventually light would overcome darkness, and the purpose of man's life on earth was to release the light imprisoned in his material body. The light could be released by eating bread, vegetables, or fruit containing seeds, but it was more deeply imprisoned by eating meat or animal products. I guess these were early vegetarians. Sexual activity also impeded the release of light, since light was contained in the seed of man. Thus, Manichaeans believed that the soul of God was constantly being freed from its physical fetters in the natural process of growth and death, but that it also was continually being encumbered by the act of procreation. In other words, sexual intercourse chained one's soul to Satan and denied its progress into the kingdom of light. For the Manichaean, even marriage was sin. Procreation defiled the divine substance. Sexual sin consisted not only of the act of sex, but of the very impulse. Saint Augustine, Bishop of Hippo, was far and away the most influential of the fathers of the Christian Church. His was a deeply ingrained antipathy for sex. The LDS scholar James L. Barker concluded it would seem that Manichaeanism was in part or wholly responsible for Augustine's interpretation of Paul's antagonism between the flesh and the spirit. It was Barker who said that as a theologian, Augustine was, quote, surpassed by no one in the whole history of Christian theology, and sometimes called the Christian Plato. Augustine adopted and applied to theology whatever truth he thought he found in Plato, Cicero, Plotinus, and other philosophers. Augustine gave sexual asceticism its most extreme form in Christianity. He contended that the act of generation is sin itself and determines the transmission ipso facto of the sin to the new creature. This doctrine is now known as that of original sin. It was impregnated in Catholicism and later transferred to most of Protestantism. Augustine was disgusted by the human body and especially by the female form, saying, "Between feces and urine we are born." It was Augustine who gave Latin expression to Plato's two forms of love by distinguishing divine love from Cupid love, calling the latter the root of all evil. Augustine believed that in an uncorrupted Garden of Eden, copulation would take place without penetration. Without the seductive stimulus of passion, with calmness of mind and with no corrupting of the integrity of the body, the husband would lie upon the bosom of his wife. No wild heat of passion would arouse those parts of the body. The semen could have been introduced into the womb of the wife with the integrity of the female genital organ being preserved. Just as now, with that same integrity being safe, the menstrual flow of blood can be emitted from the womb of a virgin. Thus, not the eager desire of lust, but the normal exercise of will should join the male and female for breeding and conception. Augustine felt that it would be no great misfortune if humans simply refused to procreate and the human race thus perished. Another of the church fathers who had a strong impact on the formulation of Christian sexual ethics was Augustine's contemporary, Ambrose. who became Bishop of Milan in 371. Ambrose was a brilliant writer who molded classical learning in a Christian context. He taught, "She who does not believe is a woman and should be designated by the name of her sex, whereas she who believes progresses to perfect manhood, to the measure of the adulthood of Christ. She then dispenses with the name of her sex, the seductiveness of youth and the garrulousness of old age." Ambrose was so horrified of women's genitals that he promoted the notion that when Jesus was born, he never passed down Mary's vagina, but appeared miraculously at the appointed time. Augustine concurred with this choice bit of misogyny. Ambrose's contemporary, Jerome, held similar misogynistic views, saying, "As long as woman is for birth and children, she is different from man as body is from soul. But when she wishes to serve Christ more than the world, then she will cease to be a woman and will be called man." As with Augustine, it would be difficult to overestimate Jerome's influence on Christian thought. His scholarly works were the basis of the Vulgate. Like many of the monastics, Jerome was bedeviled and guilt-ridden by sexual desire. When tempted by thoughts of the female sex, Jerome beat his breast with stones, but lamented that he was unable to drive the girl out of his heart. 100 years later, Benedict would lay down on a bed of thorns when overtaken by sexual desire. In the 13th century, the imperatives of male hormones were no less pronounced when Francis of Assisi combated them by making snowballs. Perhaps this was an early forerunner of the cold shower. St. Bernard, the 12th century monk whose preaching launched the Second Crusade, called woman the gate of hell. In the interest of time, we shall have to leap now to the 13th century and St. Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas probably is second only to Augustine in influence on Christian theology and philosophy. He reaffirmed Augustinian philosophies, assuring their supremacy until our present day. Aquinas followed Aristotle's belief that nature always wishes to produce a male. Woman is a man gone wrong, a deformity. He used the philosophical method of arriving at truth and was possessed of great abilities as a thinker and writer. Aquinas believed that the celibate life was to be preferred because it was, quote, unseared by the heat of sexual desire which is experienced in achieving the greatest bodily pleasure, which is that of conjugal intercourse. Following Augustine, Aquinas said of Eve that she was not fitted to help man except in generation because another man would have proved more effective in anything else. I'm not sure who that would have left to do the housework, but Aquinas considered any sexual act not having the potential to lead to conception to be unnatural and a sin against nature. Even coitus that could lead to conception was sinful if performed in any position other than what modern Americans have come to call the missionary position, which is face-to-face, male on top. All other positions Aquinas considered unnatural and a worse sin than masturbation. Aquinas deplored sexual relations even in marriage, saying, "I feel that nothing so casts down the manly mind from its heights as the fondling of women and those bodily contacts which belong to the married state." As Aquinian philosophies ripened in the Catholic Church, sex and sexuality became increasingly associated with shame and guilt, to the point that even the name of the sex organs must not be uttered. Seminary students referred to the penis as the diabolical servant, and they called the vagina Satan's den. Lest the sight of their own genitals remind them of sex, mirrors were forbidden in baths, and modesty powder was poured into the bath water to cloud it so the bather would not see his or her own nudity. From Aquinas, we leap directly to the modern theology and philosophy. Although erotophobia and misogyny can be and have been traced from generation to generation, as we have told in an unbroken chain. I apologize for not having made a clearer separation between erotophobia and misogyny, and for not giving greater balance to the topic of misogyny. But I presume that the roots of both erotophobia and misogyny have been laid bare in the theological and philosophical evidence now before us. For me, it has been at once encouraging and disheartening to learn of the roots of these two prominent attitudes in Western civilization. I am encouraged to learn that neither of these values were the invention of my generation, nor of my parents or grandparents. The fact that erotophobia and misogyny are so deeply rooted in our culture is disheartening because it suggests a long, difficult, and discouraging struggle to rid society of these evils. Such deeply ingrained values are not easily changed. I hope that discovering the sources of erotophobia and misogyny, however, will help us to combat them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Day. Our respondent will be Mary Beth Rains. She's on the Sunstone Board of Trustees. She has a master's in family relationships from BYU and an MSW from the U of U. She's a licensed clinical social worker and family therapist in private practice here in Salt Lake, an adjunct assistant professor of social work at the U of U, where she teaches family therapy classes, and her treatment specialties are in marriage and family topics, sex therapy, and sexual abuse. She has written some articles on sexuality, and these have appeared in Sunstone. After Mrs. Rains gives her response, we'll have some time for questions. Mary Beth Rains.
I appreciate Terry giving us an overview of the men's version of the sexual history or how we came to view sex in Christianity today. I'm rather in an awkward position, however, since I have as many dissenting comments to his paper as I have assenting. Since I'm not a scholar or historian of sexual and Christian thought, I would like to give some analogous or some other comments also. In fact, I'm reminded today of a situation that happened to me probably about 15 years ago, in which I went to a stake conference and was very upset by a talk that was given by one of the stake authorities on how women should treat their husbands with total obedience, and made my comments known to him later, and we have since become very good friends. So I hope in that light, Terry, even though I may give some dissenting views, that we will become very good friends. I have four points I'd like to make, one short, three long. One is that I believe that Terry gives too much positive view to the Judaic tradition of sexuality. It is true, everything he said, and as my friend over the stake presidency, I don't disagree with what he has said as much as I disagree with what he has not said. And so I will add what I think should have been said in this paper. I think the Jewish may have had an underlying positive view of sex, but since they place women in such an inferior position and do not allow them equal voice or action, that point is often lost, particularly for 50% of the population of women. The second point I'd like to make is that in Terry's paper about the Christian view of sexuality, he only cites male sources for the most part. In his bibliography, he cites two female sources, one of whom he does not quote. It seems to me that in solving the issue and problem of male-female opposition in sexuality, or solving the problem of misogyny, we have to include women in the speaking. We cannot solve any differentness issue, whether it's classism, racism, ethnic differences, by excluding the part or the person or the class of people whom we are trying to learn to love. In other words, in this discussion of how sexuality is seen in Christianity or how sexuality is seen in the church, women's voices must be as incorporated as men's voices, it seems to me. In fact, I would recommend three books to you, one of whom I brought today. The best, I think, is Rhianne Eisler, The Chalice and the Blade, is a historical book, much as Terry's paper is, and gives the women's history of sexuality and how it's seen today in Christianity and other Western cultures. Two other books, Gilda Lerner, which he cites in his paper, The Creation of Patriarchy, and the third book, Marilyn French, Beyond Power. As women speak to women and men speak to men, and if we speak to only these groups to each other, we will not, I think, bring a synthesis after a while. We, in fact, need to speak to each other, women to men and men to women, and vice versa. It seems to me that an important reason in incorporating both sexes in this discussion about misogyny and who's included and who's equal and so on is not just that we need to understand the other side. So much of what is written, it seems to me, in Terry's paper and in Male Thought about sexuality and much of Western civilization, in fact, is based on opposition. Right, wrong, good, bad, light, dark, hard, soft, anyway. And by bringing in women's voices or even human voices, we introduce other elements. We don't just introduce the opposite in trying to reconcile it. We are introducing other elements, such as enjoyment of the senses or warmth or love in the whole process. I'm reminded much of the process of French braiding, which takes two elements of hair, and then in the process of creating the braid, you have to bring in a third. And the final product is not one of a synthesis of opposites. It, in fact, is a whole new creation in and of itself. Third idea I'd like to comment on is that I wish Terry had really developed the idea of erotophobia a little more, and I would like to add a couple of things about that. It seems interesting in the long history of asceticism and of fear of sex and punishment for sex that an interesting dynamic seems to be set up. And I'm reminded of how this occurs in women sexual abuse victims and even male sexual abuse victims. Women who have been cut in the process of being sexually abused, in the later years, many times cut themselves or burn themselves if they have been burned, or beat themselves if they have beaten. That we assume many times the same form of punishment or the same form of abuse for that thing that we are afraid of or that we think we need to be punished for. It seems to me in this whole history of asceticism that the whole underlying value of we are on earth, we need to be punished, mortal life is not good in some way, that the way to get out of punishment is to punish more. The way to get out of deprivation is to deprive more. So that, in fact, if passion is not good and it's punishment, you go totally away from it. In fact, I would submit that oftentimes another view, a female view, even Carl Jung's psychological view, is that you have to incorporate the opposite. You have to go into it and understand it. You cannot get rid of the dark by boxing it in a box. It only becomes more dark. Or as Robert Bly says, those parts of ourselves that we do not truly learn to love in every way will eventually become an enemy part of our personality. We become split off and keep the war going. One way to reconcile this issue, it seems to me, about the issue of fear of sex, fear of women, really was addressed yesterday in James Fowler's talk. I don't know how many of you went, but it seems to me that the whole issue of fear of sex, fear of women, punishment, really fits on a lower spiritual developmental stage, and that we will not overcome fear of sex, fear of women, fear of passion by excluding it and making it absolutely non-existent, but by learning to love it, by learning to achieve some consciousness, to learn to live with the paradoxes of being, to learn to live with light and shadow interface as we do visually every day as we look at each other. If we only saw light or we only saw shadow, we could not see the human form and we could not see each other. In other words, we don't finish fear off by killing it. We finish fear off by transcending it, by incorporating it, and by learning to love it. My last point, major point, is that I wish Terry would have included more in his conclusion, more ways in which we can stem the tide in this generation, or learn to share the blessings of sexuality in our lives. Again, I believe his paper was very helpful in giving this history, and I, in fact, was at the two previous papers and believe those are all helpful additions. We need more writings about Mormon sexuality. However, I think many times we are caught in that writing, and the same thing that happens almost in missionary work and in Western traditional writing, in that we pick apart what is wrong. We elucidate what is in error, and we do not state what is right. That part of creation, or part of molding something new, is in finding out what is wrong, certainly. But the bigger effort is in finding out what is right. In other words, I think we heal out of goodness and out of growth, not just out of scrubbing something out or out of cleaning something out. Let me suggest a couple of ways in Mormon culture today that we might, in fact, stem the tide or bring forth a greater fullness. One is in language. And keep in mind, I'm rushing through this. I could think of three or four others, but since I'd like to leave some time for discussion, I'm just mentioning two. One is in language. I think the metaphors that we use about sexuality are often part of the problem. For instance, clean and dirty, or unclean or chaste, those oppositional words are many times a way of continuing a sense that sex and bodies are dirty or unclean, or that we should have no passion in us. I think we should use other words. We can use appropriate, inappropriate. We should use positive words towards the body at every point. And I have three teenage children, and so I listen to what church people say to them in talks and family meetings and so on. And even though I think we have become much better over the years, I still think we have a ways to go, because we're still using the words clean and dirty about not only sex, but about parts of our body and sexual fluids. And I think that, one way to give a clear description of that is that the word moist, if we're applying it to food, it always has a positive connotation, right? Moist meat, moist cake, moist whatever. If we apply it to sex, however, moist often has a negative connotation. Moist bodies, moist whatever. Now, you're actually experiencing it in love with it, it doesn't have a negative connotation at all. It's a very positive one. But in terms of talking about it many times outside of the experience, it has a negative one, which is what I would like to suggest as the second idea, which is that we include our experience in our talking about sex. We don't just talk about our theology. One of the missing pieces, I believe, in Mormons discussing sexuality and in all of the world, is to have us write what we experience, what is healthy, what is wonderful. And I think there are particularly two things that we should include that are not often included in the history of sexuality. One of them is aliveness. I believe that for those of us who have become sexually experienced and really have become alive in the experience of sexual intercourse or lovemaking, frenzied passion is a wonderful descriptor. Even though Augustine or whomever said it negatively, it is a wonderful experience. It provides not just an experience of the body, but many people will describe, and this is true as I talk to people in my practice and my own experience, that it really opens us in deeper places, in farther places in our soul, and it opens us to heal the places in us that have been wounded, that have been sealed off from any kind of love and punishment. The second feeling, I think, many times, besides the aliveness, is the wonder, the kind of exploring that passion can bring, and I think we should include that. There's one writer who has written two or three poems in Mormon thought, Mary Bradford. In the original dialogue issue on sexuality, she wrote two poems which were quite sensuous and quite alive, and if you can get access to that, please do, and read her things. There have also been several poems written by women in Exponent 2 about sexuality, and I have to admit to the same bias as Terry in that I tend to follow women's writings more than I follow men's writings, and so I'm sure there must be some men's writings about sexuality, but I have not cataloged them and kept them in my consciousness as much as Terry may do about men's writings. I think that we can incorporate and say our experience and say it out loud and say it proudly, and that synthesis of the aliveness and the wonder and of the joy, I think, of sexuality will effectively kill, or not kill, but incorporate and transcend erotophobia, only a male view, and our fear of sex within the church. And I say this in the name of Jesus. Oh, jeez. I say the thing.
Give me a church talk.
Thank you. Yes, please go ahead.
If we believe in the fall, right? And the fact that it was an effluvia the mucous membrane is an auxiliary wasting agent, and most is common. They throw out a lot of plants. Women have an advantage. They have an auxiliary waste removal channel. In the Middle Ages, they used bleeding as an analog of this for everybody across the board. Knowing that perhaps women were healthier by virtue of extra exit of filth and sewage inside any man. Now look, just because the ancients were inept at dealing with sin, and evil and sexual perversion and corruption, which is manifest in broadcast. I mean, just look around you. What are you trying to do? Stick your heads into the sand with a lot of terminology and human euphemism?
Excuse me,
dear. You are corrupt. It's an objective fact.
Do you have a question to direct to one of them?
Now, this is my question. It's the fact that they were poor in their adjustment, which you criticize, and the surgeon had adjustment. They were trying. They were human beings. Trial and error through all history. We're still trying. That doesn't mean that there's not a light ahead at the time, that we won't pull out, and that we won't integrate sexuality with reproduction. So, all of this. How do you explain the hypothesis of sex as not being dirty, with the fact that it is dirty?
I think rather obviously I do not believe that it is dirty. I hope that was made clear.
I think
I am going to. I hope that nothing that I have said is interpreted as an endorsement of extramarital sex, premarital sex. No, I believe very strongly in what the Mormon Church teaches about the proper role of sex being confined to marriage. Unfortunately, the long-standing, thousands of year history of our view of sexuality and the way that we currently try to teach moral sexual behavior also paints marital sex as dirty, and I will not accept that.
Your response to my question.
Yeah. Then I didn't understand it.
Sexual manifestation is perverted. Marriage, religious sex, everything.
That's well, that's what Plato and Aristotle believed. That is not what the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints today currently believes, and I would invite you to read the manual. Now, I'm talking now about the general authorities, the president of the church. Read A Parent's Guide, which is published by the First Presidency of the Church, and it says that sex is good and wholesome. Please.
Sir, I believe honestly we can't answer your question, because I think my view and Terry's view are so diametrically opposed to the assumption that sex is dirty, that if you start with the assumption that sex is
dirty,
well, that the body or I don't even believe that men's is a waste removal, quite frankly, and women's history and women's view of that history of our bodies is so entirely different. It is not based on that assumption at all. In fact, in many cultures.
Why do you think that this extreme, you know, what, is there something in their lives or what?